These are the slides that we handed out last week that are on GLSL. So far, we've really done a lot. We looked at the fundamental GPU architecture, looked at using CUDA to program it, and looked at some parallel algorithms on top of it, maybe your favorite band stream compaction that you used in the path tracer. We hit the graphics pipeline pretty good from the foundations of it. We haven't spent as much time like on the geometry shader and tessellation as I would like to, but I will maybe at least give you some resources for if you want to do final projects, especially on tessellation shaders, which allow us to create massive amounts of geometry on the GPU. So, for example, a good use case there is if you have terrain rendering, and as you zoom in, you want the terrain, you run out of your right, you have your highest resolution terrain, but the triangle starts to get flat, but you want to keep re-subdividing those. So the tessellation is one use case for that. But we hit the graphics pipeline pretty good. So now I want to look a little bit at the graphics APIs to program the graphics pipeline, really OpenGL and WebGL. And I know that you've seen them a little bit from 460, but I'm going to hit them from a little bit different angle, and I'm certainly going to focus on the shading language, on the kernels that we write that run on the video card. And I think given what you've done with your rasterizer, this is going to be super easy, and everything should be clear as day, I think. And I'll be curious to talk to you guys about this, because this is, like I said, we haven't implemented our own rasterizers before, but now I'll be curious how it impacts your learning of this material. So what I'm going to do is I talked, when we looked at the evolution of GPU hardware, I talked about fixed function where it's programmable. And I want to show from a programmer's perspective a concrete example. What does that mean, fixed function versus programmable? And then we're just going to get into the OpenGL shading language. Okay, so here's just a bread and butter technique that you've probably seen in 460, which is a light map. So we have two textures. One is pre-computed intensity. That's the light map on the left. Then one is surface color, a diffuse map. And I just want to multiply them to make it look like that thing is lit. So a use case here might be I have a bunch of lights. I'm going down a long hallway, and there's a bunch of lights there. And those lights, instead of computing all that in real time, I just pre-compute one light map based on that light on that wall, and I just tile it all over the place, and it's super fast compared to actually doing you treating those as real light sources. And this is still widely done in games, in the mid-2000s, this was everywhere. And of course, it's not particularly good for dynamic lights because this assumes that the light is static. So in the shader, in your fragment shader, this is as simple as multiplying these two textures together. And that's it. I multiply two textures and say I'm done. So here is some OpenGL code. And I will assume that you've all at least been somewhat exposed to OpenGL in 460, but you know, it's a C-based API such that it allows us to access the graphics hardware from a graphics perspective, not from a compute perspective like we do in CUDA, without actually knowing how the hardware works or anything about the drivers or the bus protocols. And all the functions here, since it's C-based, begins with GL underscore, because there's no namespaces like there would be in C++. But here, we're going to say, hey, look, I'm going to enable texturing. I'm going to say that we're going to read from textures. And then I have two textures. These are two images that are in memory that don't worry about how we created them. But I have these calls, GL text and var f. And these are saying that we're going to multiply these textures together. And so this is what I mean by a fixed function pipeline. We're not programming it, but we're configuring it. We're going to call functions to configure options. And then eventually, this bottom call here, sorry, gl draw star, that's not a real function. That's not valid syntax, but that star is just a wild card because there's lots of gl draw functions, gl draw elements, gl draw arrays. But this invokes the kernel. This executes the pipeline. This is when we say draw this g, and we pass it some geometry, and then we have some state that we assigned, and we have our shaders that we're going to run. So that, just think of that as do the draw, draw the scene or draw that particular model. But here, you know, I wrote all this C code. It called all these functions to say multiply two textures, right? So we look at the fixed function, and it's configurable. It's limited, though, because we only have whatever the hardware people decided to make, and as well as what the API decided to expose. And generally, at least a very bloated API. So now, this is sort of old news at this point, but say 2007, OpenGL was this giant API. It had so many different entry points, so many different functions. You know, it might have been like over 2,000 different functions, a very large API. And it had this long legacy being, at the time, about 15 years old. And a lot of that stuff was from fixed function features that were burned into hardware, but then no longer made sense as these programmable stages came out. So the API was enormous. And there's eight, I want to send geometry to the video card. I want to send my mesh to the video card. There's like six different ways to do it. And well, maybe not six, but there's display list. There's immediate mode, there's display list, there's client-side vertex arrays, and there's vertex buffer objects. And you had to know the API really well to know which one to use, you know. So what happened was they started depreciating big parts of the API and said, well, this no longer makes sense, and this is no longer fast on today's hardware. So now the OpenGL API, I think, is pretty beautiful. And as someone who's based their career on the API, I'm definitely biased, but I think that it's very, very nice. And I have nothing bad to say about Direct3D, by the way. Actually, I just don't know that much about Direct3D, so I can't say one way or the other. I will say that our book, OpenGL Insights, does have one chapter that mentions Direct3D, so I felt good about us having some neutrality to the book. So back to this fixed function, it becomes a pain to use because there's so many different function calls you got to make. You're like, geez, in this case for the light map, I'm just trying to multiply two pixels together, and you got to call all these functions in order to do that, and it just becomes a total headache. And generally, it's also just it's not as cool as writing shaders. Like everyone wants to be like, oh, I did that in the shader. I did this in the shader. So I do want to say, though, when I first made these slides, which was for spring of 2011, this was definitely true, and it's still true today, but the fixed function hardware and fixed function APIs exposing the functionality of that hardware are not a thing of the past, and they're not going to go away 100% because you can do things faster in straight hardware than you can making it programmable. And the main example there is rasterization. So those rasterization functions that you implemented in CUDA, they're built into the hardware. And then same with texture filtering. And there's a few other big ones. And not only do they perform better, but they also use much less power. And they also take much less transistor budget. So certain things, especially with mobile now, certain things are probably going to remain fixed function, like rasterization and texture filtering. But as new features come in, usually it's not about adding some new fixed function stage. It's about a new programmable stage. Or, like we saw with tessellation shaders, some of you may have seen if you're interested, we added two new programmable stages, but one fixed function stage in the middle because it made sense to use fixed function. So, so let's change that fixed function code and use a shader. And this is a fragment shader. It may look relatively similar to a kernel that you wrote for your fragment shaders. The only thing here is I'm using GLSL before I formally introduced GLSL. But let's just take a look at some of this code. So here I have two samplers, they're called, sampler 2D, and they're uniform. So these are just two textures, two images that are going to get fed to each fragment. And then here is the texture coordinate. So this is just like you had whatever data you had come in your fragment shaders. You probably had normals, maybe screen space positions. And now I'm going to read from these two textures. One of them is a light map, and I do dot R. I'm just getting one channel out of it because it's single channel intensity. And then the color, the diffuse map, or the color, the surface color, is three channels. I call it the RGB. And then look, I multiply these. That's my modulate. Right. So this is pretty simple. It's just like read these two values, multiply them together, and then output this color. And now when you look at all this C code that I wrote on the CPU, I can get rid of a lot of it because I no longer am telling this fixed function hardware to do stuff. Instead, I get rid of all that stuff, and then I just say, I made this program, and I'll show you guys next week how do you, basically the equivalent of how do you launch kernels. like you saw to launch kernels in CUDA, and I'll show you how to do it in OpenGL. And you're probably going to think that it's like a ton of work, and it is actually a ton of work. But it's a good illustration to show, to give you a good flavor for the API. But here, before I do my draw call, I say use this program, and that program will have a vertex and a fragment shader. And then when you do the draw, it will call those shaders. So in general, you write these shaders, and they're going to run right on the GPU, just like your shaders did that you wrote in your CUDA kernels. And then you tell OpenGL to execute it. And you're going to wind up with a lot less CPU code, a lot less code that's in your C files that's calling APIs. And you're going to see a lot more in GLSL files. And then, you know, I was borderline bitter when I made these slides for getting the fixed function error. So I probably was a little bitter. So in my earlier days doing graphics, we had an older graphics engine that had a ton of fixed function code in it, a ton of it. And one of the things that I did was bring it up to the modern OpenGL standards, which means I went through and was like, this is depreciated. I got to rewrite this and rewrite this. And I learned the API really well that way. But it looks like I got a little battle wounded. I used to use this slide and say, you know, say no to fixed function shading and use programmable shading. Although I'd say it's, at this point, based on how we've developed this course, this semester at the Rasterizer, this is probably just like obvious to you guys. Oh yeah, since I crossed out the say no to drugs, I have to give you the disclaimer. The last thing I need is Patrick Hoser from University of Pennsylvania crossed out, say no to drugs. So definitely say no to drugs. Okay, so I do want to ask you one thing that we probably thought about a little bit with our CUDA kernels, but we're going to see that the OpenGL pipeline has these two programmable stages, vertex shaders and fragment shaders, but more recent versions have even more stages. And as software developers, we kind of have to figure out, well, what version of the pipeline are we willing to use? Because we might have we can reach more users. So the pipeline that I've introduced so far, which is based on OpenGL ES2, if you implement that, you will run everywhere. Okay, that is OpenGL ES2 powers your phones. OpenGL ES2 powers WebGL, which runs in the web browser. OpenGL ES2 is the foundation for OpenGL that runs on your desktop on Linux, Windows, and Mac. So that is a fantastic baseline. Then as you move into the OpenGL 3 and 4, you're going to get more and more features, but you're going to need more recent hardware as well. So it's going to be up to you as a developer to pick that trade-off. One thing I want you to keep in mind, though, too, that I think a lot of people don't, except for game companies, they're pretty good at it, is it's going to take you time to build your software. So like, especially if you're doing like a AAA game, that might take 3 years. And at that time, what GPUs are going to be everywhere, right? So you need to think about it. But I'm very happy now to say that like OpenGL S2 is not only is it everywhere, but it's also a very useful API. Like I used to do my virtual globe book is written against OpenGL 3.3, but now I do pretty much only OpenGL ES2. But I don't mind it. I mean, I would love the newer features, certainly, but it's still a very capable API. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about this shader execution model in general, and then we'll look at the its manifestation in GLSL. So people will say, oh, it's a streaming model where data comes in the shader, and then data goes out, and then you have these constant inputs coming in. So in your rasterization pipeline here, streaming coming in was each individual vertex, or was each individual fragment, and then streaming coming out was your transforms vertex, or your colored fragment, and then these uniforms coming in, these were whatever things that you had in global memory, or for example, when you passed in your shader, your model of your projection matrices. Okay, good. So now, of course, we might not just be one shader, and on the GPU we can run multiple shaders in parallel, where the constants coming in at the top, they're accessible to all the different shader invocations. But the streaming input, you'll get a different value from the stream in each individual shader. That's good. Yeah, it has no side effects. This is interesting. So when we do shaders in GLSL and OpenGL ES2, and what will, and there is no quiz as to what features and what version of OpenGL. There is no quiz for that, but and the base OpenGL version that we're going to be working with, shaders can't have side effects, which means that we can't in a shader go to global memory and write some value, and then some other shader could read it. In the most recent versions of OpenGL, this is no longer true, which is why I have this star up there, where what we see is a lot of the features that are in, like, CUDA, for example, or OpenCL, have made their way into the graphics API, which is kind of one reason why we've been doing so much compute-based rendering in this course, is because I want you to be ready for those trends. But now, in the most more recent versions, we will see things like atomics. And you could do very simple things with, say, atomics, for example. Atomic counter, I might want to go, no. Okay, when I render the scene, how many total fragments did I shade? And you can do that by just atomically increasing the value in the fragment shader. And there's lots of other things that we can do where now we can have data structures that are shared. And order-independent translucency is a great example for that. So I guess what's important is when you don't have these side effects, then these shaders can all execute independently. So it's the data-level parallelism that we've been seeing throughout the semester, where every kernel invocation is parallel to every other one. So every shader invocation is in parallel. But what's really important for the graphics API, and I think I at least briefly mentioned this last week, is that the parallelism is implicit. When you issue this draw call, when I say GL draw elements, or GL draw array, and I say take this model and draw it, and here's my shader to go with it, you invoke the parallel processor, you invoke the GPU, but the graphics programmer doesn't have to know anything about parallel programming. They didn't set up a grid size, they didn't set up a block size, they didn't think about shared memory, they didn't do any sync threads or anything like that. They just wrote a shader that it ran on each fragment, a vertex, ran a shader, ran on each fragment, and said, go execute this GPU. And this is why you'll hear, and I don't know if there's solid evidence backing this up, but there might be, but definitely you hear graphics advocates say that graphics APIs like OpenGL and Direct3D are the most popular parallel programming or most successful parallel programming APIs because the users don't even know that they're doing parallel programming because the parallelism is implicit. So there it is. There's my images that disappeared. But everyone knows the only thing that's important here is that for now in this pipeline, it's vertex shader and fragment shader. They're what's programmable, and they're what we're going to be looking at programming in GLSL. And I can introduce, by the way, GLSL, the shading language, without really talking a whole lot about OpenGL, too. It's definitely, you might be like, well, wow, shouldn't you tell me about OpenGL a lot before you tell me about the shading language? But as you'll see, you're going to, with your assignments, you're going to write a little bit of OpenGL, where basically you're going to create a shader, then say use program, like you'll write a couple lines, but really all you're going to do is implement different shaders. So let me show you now, maybe a little more formally, a very simple vertex shader and a very simple fragment shader, and just, yep. This slide's classic, complete junk, yeah.
Yeah, classic OpenGL 2 and OpenGL 2.
Yeah, what does all these different terms mean? So OpenGL ES is OpenGL embedded systems. It's OpenGL that's made really for your phone, but also for tablets, set-top boxes, like cable boxes. And what's the difference between OpenGL 2 and OpenGL ES2? I'd say not very much. When you say OpenGL without ES, that's strictly OpenGL desktop. But when they came up with OpenGL ES, they derived it from the desktop version. For our purposes, OpenGL 2 and OpenGL ES2 can be loosely the same thing. And then they have very similar functionality to Direct3D 9. And right now they're on Direct3D 11, it's the latest version. In fact, what's really interesting there, and I will have a chapter for you guys to read, and I'll briefly talk about it in class, but when you look at WebGL, which is the API that's driving 3D in the web, well, I'll tell you, I've based my career around OpenGL. I have, but as of recently, I've based my career around WebGL over at least the past year and a half. WebGL on Windows actually gets converted to Direct3D 9 and then ran with Direct3D. only on Windows, not on Linux and Mac, because there's no Direct3D there. But it's not as easy as you would think. You think, oh, well, I get one API call, and then I just call this other API. Like, it's not just like a one-to-one mapping. And then the shaders, it's a different shading language that needs to get translated. But there's all these interesting difficulties in doing that. And I had the guys who wrote the layer that does that transformation, they wrote a chapter in my book, in OpenGL Insights. And when I talk about WebGL, I will hand out that chapter along with the intro chapter to it that my friend and I wrote.
Does this have any fixed function?
What about the fixed function?
Like, does classic OpenGL 2, is it based on the fixed function?
Yeah, OpenGL 2 has programmable vertex and fragment shaders, and then everything else is fixed function. So the rasterizers, fixed function, primitive assembly, vertex assembly, depth testing, that kind of stuff. And then since then, we've added only a few new programmable stages, and then just more bells and whistles around it. Any other questions? Okay, so let's look at this vertex shader. And again, this code is in GLSL, but I want you to think about comparing it to what you did in your CUDA kernel. It should be very, very similar. And GLSL, like CUDA, is based on C. Okay, but it's simpler than C in a lot of ways because, for example, it doesn't have pointers or virtual functions. Virtual functions aren't in C either, but they're in C++. But it does have other things, like, for example, vectors and matrices are built into it. And you can do, then there's a nice library for doing all sorts of math that's very useful to graphics. Okay, in this particular shader, here I have these uniforms that are up top, this uniform that's up top, and that will be the same for all vertices coming in. And this is the model view projection matrix, so go from model coordinates to clip coordinates. And then this attribute vec4 position, that is the position of the vertex that this shader is going to execute. So from shader to shader, that's going to be a different vertex. And it's vec4 because this is in homogeneous coordinates, so the W is 1, just so the matrix multiplication works out, so you can do the scale, rotation, and translation in the same matrix. Okay, then this main function should look just like C code. And then this bottom line here, I multiply the position by the model view projection matrix, and then I write it to this special output variable, GL_position, and say that's what I'm outputting the clip coordinates. And this is a full valid GLSL shader. And it might, the one line of code that's actually there may look almost equivalent to whatever you did in your CUDA kernel. Cool? Okay. Now, here's a little more complicated vertex shader where what I did is I got two attributes for input. So now a vertex has both position and color. Okay, and then I also have two outputs. I still have my standard GL position output, but then I added these varying variables, and I called it FS_color. And the FS is for fragment shader. It's just a naming convention. You certainly don't have to do that. So now this vertex shader transforms the position from model coordinates to clip coordinates, and then it passes through the color. And why it's called varying there is because it will vary over that triangle when rasterization does interpolation. Okay, so then let's look at the fragment shaders again from the GLSL perspective. And recall, coming in, we're going to have this built-in variable called GLFragChord, where the X and Y is the screen space position, and the Z is the depth value. And then these values come from being interpolated from the vertex shader, along with any varyings that we sent through. And then, of course, you can pass in your uniforms. Mainly textures are widely used. And then the output is the color, most often, but like we discussed when we went over the pipeline, we can do other things like change the depth value, which is very useful if you're going to implement ray marching or ray casting inside the shader. And then in newer versions of OpenGL, pretty much everything above OpenGL ES2, we can output multiple colors, I'll just say, or multiple output values, and that's useful for deferred shading. And in fact, when you do your screen space ambient occlusion, we're going to write code for you that does output multiple values. So one thing that we're going to do is we're going to output just depth, and then you're going to analyze the depth buffer and try to figure out what parts are in shadow due to ambient light. But then we'll also output depth and normals, and then based on depth and normals, you can do a more precise calculation there. And I'll go over ambient occlusion before you do that. I have to go over that before you implement it for Project 5. And there's also a section, if you guys have the book Real-Time Rendering, there's a good section on ambient occlusion, which is my lecture material directly comes from that part of the book for that.
Can you explain the difference between attribute and gradient?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's go back to this vertex shader here. Attributes and the vertex shader are coming in, and they're coming from the vertex assembly stage of the pipeline. So you put together your mesh, and each vertex has one or more attributes. Varying is an output from the vertex shader that's input to the fragment shader. And it will still be called varying in the fragment shader in terms of the GLSL syntax. And it's called varying because of it varies across the triangle because of the interpolation.
But then you also said that position is being sent to the fragment shader, right?
It is. So that is done. So when you see these purple GL_position, why isn't that a varying is what you're asking, right? Yeah, and that's a fair question. GL_position is built in to GLSL. And what you're kind of doing there is you're taking that clip space position and you're passing it to the fixed function pipeline, who then is going to do perspective division and clipping and all that stuff. So.
Can the value of the uniform be varied?
So you can take a uniform coming in, like for example, say color didn't vary per vertex, say there is just one color for the whole model, you could have a uniform here, and then you could pass it through a varying variable to the fragment shader. You could do that. Is that your question or no?
I mean, can a uniform variable's value be modified?
Modified where? In the shader?
Yeah.
I think that you could write to it, but you would only see it within that shader invocation, but you can't write. You can't have side effects in OpenGL ES2. You couldn't change that uniform and then expect another shader to know that it changed.
Oh.
Other questions?
So it's not like a constant.
I don't know. I think that you can write to it, and within that invocation, it would let you write to it. I'm not sure if that's a compiler error or not. I'd have to try it. But it certainly is not something that's seen outside of the shader. Actually, I would bet that the compiler doesn't let you write to it, but I don't know. I haven't tried. I would say it would be bad practice to write to it if it lets you. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at a simple fragment shader. So this is the simplest fragment shader. Actually, I could make one a little bit simpler than this. But here, what do you think this thing does?
Makes the optic color red.
All right, okay, so this is the simplest possible shading. Where you just say it's a constant color. So I have a void main function just like I would in C, and any time a fragment gets shaded, it executes this thing and it says the color is red is 1, green and blue 0, alpha is 1. So it's fully transparent. And then GL frag color is just the name for passing this to say the fixed function pipeline that then will go on and do depth testing and the blending in the back end. Yep.
Alpha 1 means transparent or opaque?
Oh, what did I say? It's opaque. I don't know what I said there, but it's definitely... I'm glad you called me. Definitely opaque. And not always... Sometimes you will make frame buffers where you don't even want to care about storing alpha value. This is a VEC4, so you always have to output a VEC4, but you might not always store it in the frame buffer, depending on what you're doing. So, and please, if I ever misspeak like that, you call me on it. So, because otherwise, some people are going to believe me, and then they're going to be like in a job interview or something. Be like, well, Patrick told me that one means transparent, and then it's gonna be ugly. Okay, good. Glad that fragment shader makes sense. And here it is. I promise you, I don't know where I got that image from, but I'm telling you, that's what would happen if you drew a triangle with this shader. So let's look at a slightly more complicated shader, and here. I'm saying varying VEC3 FS_color. So this one would work with the vertex shader that I showed you guys earlier that had the varying output. And then here all I'm doing is passing that through. Now, since that's a VEC 3, that has RGB, but it doesn't have A, so I'm constructing a VEC 4 from it, where I'm saying I'm going to use the RGB from FS underscore color, then 1 for alpha. And this is beautiful. See, GLSL is really nice with vectors, being able to treat vectors as first class objects and be able to construct them from other vectors. It's really nice in that regard. And I guess this is a good time to mention that vertex and shaders and fragment shaders, they have to be compatible with each other, meaning the output of the vertex shader needs to mesh with the input of the fragment shader. And then everyone should see here that then this thing is shaded the way it is because the input, let's say, had three vertices, and each vertex had a different color, and then it was interpolated during rasterization. Okay, so a couple things that I like to say about GLSLs. You know, I like to say, look, it's like C, no pointers, no recursion, no dynamic memory allocation. So that's like base CUDA running on a GeForce 8. So it doesn't have that, but it does have these beautiful built-in vectors and matrices, and then the samplers are for accessing the textures. And then, again, constructors for them, and I'll show you some of the math library that's really useful. And I always look... Yep?
Sorry. I just wanted to clarify exactly the use of recursion. Does that mean a fragment shader function cannot call another function, or it cannot call itself?
It certainly could call another function, but it couldn't call itself. So the thing with the pipeline is, if you were to do recursion and say static code analysis can't figure out when it's going to terminate, the driver would have a hard time scheduling the hardware for the graphics pipeline, and they would have trouble like ensuring that there won't be deadlock and those sorts of things. So that's why the GLSL has the limitations that it has. Although these limitations, they really are starting to get lifted. And you really see this convergence where like OpenCL is kind of like getting smashed into OpenGL. Other questions? So when I go through some of the syntax or some of the features for GLSL, one thing that I like about it is it really lets us write some concise code. And I want to challenge you guys to write clean and concise code. Like concise isn't always clean, right? If it's terse, then it's not clean. But I think a lot of times the language is very expressive and will let you do things in a very short amount of code. So I'm going to show you a bunch of examples of that. And then same thing that I said with CUDA, but like if you know C, I mean, just start programming in GLSL. So like I can't even tell you how many languages that I don't know that I program in professionally, right? Like I consider myself a C++ programmer, but for my book, I wrote all the code in C#. I have no idea how to use C#. I mean, I just started doing it. You know, and now over the past year and a half, I've been doing all JavaScript. And again, I don't consider myself a JavaScript programmer, but I just do it. And definitely the jump from C to GLSL, I mean, the syntax is just start doing it. Don't be like, oh, I need to go, buy the Orange Book and read all about the syntax. The Orange Book is an awesome book, by the way. And you should buy that book, but you shouldn't. You don't need it for the syntax. And speaking of the Orange Book, actually, Graham Sellers, who's coming next Monday, is the new author of that book. He will be involved in that. And he can tell us more about the future of that book. I don't want to steal his thunder, but very good stuff happening in that area. Okay, so let's look a little bit at the syntax here. So look, GLSL has a preprocessor just like C, and the shaders, vertex and fragment shaders, have main functions, again, just like C. There's scalar types, just like we've seen before, and what I really care about is these vectors are built in, vector 2, vec 3, vec 4. And then there's also ones for integers and booleans, but they're less commonly used compared to the floating point values. One thing I like about these a lot is that I can access components through them as if they were a position, x, y, z, w, or as if it were a color, RGBA, or if it were a texture coordinate, s, t, p, q. So you can treat these however you want to treat them based on what you're doing, if you're doing positions, colors, texture.
Yep.
Oh, geez. Man, that is a good point. It is not a pointer. That is me not wanting to write out 2, 3, or 4. I should probably write...
I think you should use hash.
Yeah.
This is good.
Oh, man. All right. Everyone's good with this? Other questions? Okay. So these vectors also have constructors. Again, like you don't, there's no constructors in C, right? You'd have to write, well, you could kind of, you could write separate functions, I suppose. But so check out this first one, constructs a vector, 1, 2, 3, x, y, z. The next one, the 1 is spread across all the components. So x equals 1, y equals 1, z equals 1. And then you can construct vectors and then construct vectors with those vectors. So in the third example, I construct a vec 2, and then I use that to construct a vec 3. So it's really nice. And GLM, which is awesome, by the way, and you guys, maybe I didn't tell you, but the author of GLM, Christoph, is the co-editor for OpenGL Insights. So him and I did the book together. So even though he lives in France, him and I worked together like every day for who knows how much, 6 months or a year. We spent a lot of time together working on that book. But the vision for GLM was to copy GLSL as closely as possible. So with that said, man, maybe next year I'll even trim this material down more. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, why is GLM still in beta stage? Like, it's not a 1.0.
Oh, I don't know. We got to, because Christoph is a perfectionist, maybe, and he's not ready. And he's brilliant. He's an amazing person. If you guys are with me at SIGGRAPH this year, I will introduce you guys. He's really awesome. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why. But I have a feeling that he's probably not happy about one piece of it or something, and he doesn't want to call it 1.0. Or you know, maybe just hasn't gotten to it or documented. I don't know. There's lots of reasons. So if I can tell you the reason. So I work the engine that I work on. I can tell you why it's not 1.0. Well, one is we don't have enough features for it to be 1.0 yet. But the other reason is as soon as I make it 1.0, I can't break interfaces anymore. And I love to break interfaces. So, all right, more questions. Okay, so now maybe my favorite feature, and this is in, as far as I know, this is in GLM too, but swizzling, and that is the name, swizzling. So I can take the components of vectors, and I can rearrange them however I want, and it's really fast. It's so fast that it's free, or basically free. So here, I have a VEC4, and I can pull out the RGB components in that order. Or in that third line, I can switch them and go, well, BGR. I can just switch them just like that. And this code compiles. This is real code, unlike a lot of other code that I've had in here. Or maybe I want to pull out the R component three times. So that's C.RRR. That pulled out the same R component three times. And these are also L values, too, which means I can write to them. So that first assignment takes 0.5 and assigns it to the alpha component. And then the next one takes the 0 and sends it to the R and B components. And then you can even access these things as if they are vectors. So you can index into these guys as well. So there's lots of flexibility here depending on what you're doing. Again, one of my favorite features. Matrices are built in. Matrix 2, 3, and 4. MAT 4 is what you're used most often. And these are column major. So let's look at a few of these. You can construct these just like you can vectors, and if you only give it a single value, that goes down the diagonal. So the first example there is an identity matrix. And then what's a shame with constructing these things, and I wrote my matrices in my engine differently, but they're stored column major, so when you construct them, they look, you're giving them one column at a time. But you really, when you look at that code, that second line of code there, you have to transpose it to understand what the actual matrix is. You know what I mean? And then you can access these using subscript notation, column by followed by row. But you can also treat them as an array of column vectors. So, for example, this float x equals m subscript 0.x takes the first column, and then it takes the first value. And then the bottom line of code takes the second value and takes the y and z out of it, so the second and third values. Pretty cool. Lots of flexibility there. You're going to write some beautiful code for your image processing.
Can we also do m.x.x or something like that?
m.x. So you can't treat, as far as I know, you can't treat the columns as a vector. You could try it and let me know if otherwise, though. And then all of the matrix operations, anything that you can think of that's sane works. I want to multiply a matrix by a matrix. It just works. I want to multiply a vector by a matrix as long as they're of, you know, the, as long as they're compatible, it works, and so on. And you can be assured that these are very fast too in the GPU hardware. Okay, so we really already talked about the attribute varying and uniform stuff. So I'm not sure if there's much I want to say here. Yeah, probably nothing. There we go. The samplers, and you're going to be using samplers for the image processing, where we've already written, I mean, this assignment is so easy that I already wrote a box blur for you guys. So you're already going to have one fragment shader that takes the input texture and then reads like a 5x5 or 10x10 region and then averages that to do a simple box blur. And you're just going to take that and copy and paste it to write all your other image processing. But the texture that comes in, the image that you're going to be processing, comes in through a sampler. It's called sampler 2D. And when you want to read a value, you use this texture 2D call. And this thing says, here's the sample I'm going to read from, and here's the texture coordinate that I'm going to use to read it. And this texture coordinate will be between 0 and 1. And this will get passed in as a varying variable that I've already computed for you. And then here I'm pulling out whatever components I want. In this case, it's RGB. And then there's also cube maps, too, but you won't need them in the near future. Let's see, what do I want to say about textures that I haven't probably already told you guys? Just so the terminology is super clear, a pixel and a texture is called a texel. So I don't know if I might have had a bad habit of already using that terminology without telling you, but they're texels are a texture, just like pixels are in an image. And the texture 2D uses fixed function hardware to do filtering. So if you're zoomed way out and the texture is really small and you have a bunch of texels mapped into one pixel, the filtering where it might read multiple texels and average them, that is done in fixed function hardware. And that was one thing that I emailed out to the Piazza group about, if you want to do texture filtering or perspective correct texture interpolation, which I don't know that anyone took me up on it. I mean, I know, Muhammad, you did just regular texture mapping, right? Yeah. But did anyone try to do the perspective correct texture coordinate computations or the filtering? Well, I don't think it's that hard. I think it's just more math. Yep.
Texture have to be squared in resolution.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. So in older versions of OpenGL, there's all sorts of limitations where, oh, it has to be a power 2. And it might have also had to be squared, too. But definitely there's a power 2. And there's still some legacy power 2 restrictions, but not much. And certainly in the most recent version of OpenGL, it's like there's no restriction except for maximum texture size, which on decent hardware should be like 16K by 16K. And then here's an example texture, and I'm just showing the texture space going from 0, 0 to 1, 1. We call that normalized coordinates. So let me show you some trig function. You know, there's a bunch of trig functions for sine, cosine, etc. But you can also, not only do they work for scalars, but they work for vectors too. So if you have a vec3 that has multiple components and you pass that to one of these trig functions, it will execute the function on each of the components. So it's nice, it's handy. And then, you know, there's exponential functions, logarithmics, square root. Inverse square root, by the way, is very fast. So that's, what do we use inverse square root for in graphics? Normalizing, right? So we're always normalizing stuff. So that's built into the hardware, and it's fast. So don't be afraid to use it.
Trigonometry functions use radians or angles?
They use radians, yeah. Please use radians. I mean, if I'm looking at your code and you can't figure something out, it's just a degrees to radians thing, I'm gonna have a heart attack. So yes, please radians. Okay, so then there's a lot of other just general math functions that are widely used and that are really handy. Like min and max are good, and then clamp is used a lot too, where you have a value, you want to make sure that it's between two values. So you might even use these for lighting functions. You know, like you're computing diffuse shading, for example, and you want to make sure that you didn't flip around the other side of inside the object. So rewrite this with one line of code. I just gave you the answer.
I think it's in a clan.
It is clan. We write this without the if statement.
Sign.
Is it sign?
Two times sign.
You guys with me? So if you take the sine of x, then you're going to get negative 1 or... Oh, sorry, I didn't tell you guys what sine did. I just said, oh, there's a sine function. Right? But I had it in the comment. So if you take the sine of x here, and then you multiply it by 2, you will get the result, except for the edge case when x is 0. Right? So just be aware, because it's interesting to take conditionals like this and then rewrite them without conditionals. And if you use these library functions, you can do that. Just be careful for edge cases like this example I'm showing you here with the sign. So let's do one more. Assume I have another one. Yes, I do. And then we'll call it quits from here. Okay, so here, let's rewrite this without the if statement. So I'm saying if the root 1 is less than root 2, I return something. Otherwise, I return something else. What do you want to do? Yeah, but I said to rewrite this without the if statement. Min? There it is. And see how it's in one line here too? Where I can just put the min right in there. Okay, so as fun as these little GLSL quizzes are, class is over. So I think that we've done enough GLSL so that you'll be able to write the image processing. And yeah, there's not that much left. But please don't miss Dave's talk on Monday. Then we'll continue talking about GLSL and OpenGL on Wednesday.
Last question I had, I noticed you didn't put matrix inversion there.
So do you guys think that there's a matrix inverse function in GLSL? What do you think?
I don't know.
There is not one, and here's why. It's not very often that you would invert a matrix that needs to be inverted per vertex or per fragment. So for example, you might need to invert a matrix once on the CPU and pass it in as a uniform. So there's not inverse functions, and in fact, at least in WebGL, there's not even transpose functions. Like, I wrote some transpose functions just because I needed them. So yeah, good question. All right, have fun with your image processing.